Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 29, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps Federalist Society Practice Group's telephone conference call on today's dual oral arguments at the Supreme Court over cell phone searches and the Fourth Amendment. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome Professor Orrin S. Kerr, who is the Fred C. Stevenson Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law. A more complete bio of our speaker was provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. So with that, Professor Kerr, the floor is yours.
Great. Thanks very much. So I was at the oral argument this morning in the Supreme Court cell phone search cases, and I wanted to briefly describe the cases and then, more importantly, talk about how the court reacted and in some ways they might decide these two cases. So there are two different cases. One is involving a relatively modest search of a flip phone, pre-smartphone, and the other is a more extensive search of a smartphone, basically kind of the equivalent of an early iPhone. They were both searched incident to arrest, and the government was able to discover information inside the two phones, which then allowed them to gather evidence that they used to convict the two defendants of the crimes. The court heard oral argument in the case involving the broader search of the smartphone first, and then the more narrow search of the flip phone second. One of the questions that a lot of people had been wondering is, why did the court grant cert on both cases? Why not just pick one of them? And I think the way the oral argument went today kind of gave the answer to that question. The justices on the whole were looking, I think we'll probably allow the search incident to rest of the flip phone, the more narrow search, and then it wasn't clear where they might go with the broader search of the smartphone. Let me talk a little bit about the doctrinal context of this case to frame how the justices reacted to it. So, in a case called United States versus Robinson in 1973, the Supreme Court said that there's a bright line rule for searches on the person, that the government is allowed to conduct a complete search of everything on the person incident to arrest. And the court said there's sort of two reasons for that justify the search incident to arrest exception. One is preserving evidence of the crime, and the other is protecting officer safety in case there's some sort of a weapon, for example, on the person. And the question is how that bright line rule should apply or whether it should apply. The government's argument is pretty simple. The government's lead argument is that under United States versus Robinson, a search incident to arrest is always allowed of anything on the person, and anything includes digital evidence just like it does physical evidence, and therefore bright line rule, these searches should be allowed. That's one possibility. The defense in both of these cases comes in with the opposite rule. They say, well, the interests of the search incident to arrest exception are not furthered by a rule allowing a search of digital evidence in routine cases, and that instead the rule should be that the government has to seize digital devices but only search them pursuant to a search warrant based on probable cause. And so that was effectively the first rule based on the Robinson case was an always search rule. The defendants wanted a never search rule, or at least never without a warrant or exigent circumstances. And then there's some possibility of a middle ground test. Maybe the answer is that the government can search the cell phones incident to arrest sometimes. And there are a couple different ways that they could get there. If you think about it, a sometimes rule could have a couple different variables. There's one question of when can they go into the phone, when can they search the phone, how far can they search the phone, and then what about all the other stuff they can come up with that they find during the search of the phone that may not be evidence of the crime itself, but maybe, say, for example, evidence of other crimes. So there are lots of different middle ground rules, and one of the big questions today was Where would the justices land on this question? Would they want to have the always search rule, the never search rule, or the sometimes search rule? And if the sometimes search rule, which rule? And based on the argument today, it looked like there was little support, if any support, for a continuation of the Robinson rule. So there seemed to be relatively broad agreement among the justices that you can't apply the rule for physical evidence to digital evidence. You need to account for the fact that cell phones store so much more information that a bright line rule was justified for physical evidence because physical searches could only be so broad by their nature, but that digital evidence searches can be incredibly broad because cell phones are effectively powerful computers we just happen to carry around with us. And with smartphones, there's just so much more information and there's so much stuff that's stored that a search through a cell phone is just a different animal than a search through for physical evidence. So there was pretty broad agreement among the justices that the old rule doesn't work. And so that we can kind of, I think, rule out, at least in terms of guessing where the justices are going, the always search rule. There also didn't seem to be too much support. There was some, but not too much, for a never search rule. So I think Justice Kagan seemed to be the leading proponent of this. She was pretty skeptical of the alternatives to the never search rule. And Justice Sotomayor as well seemed to be pretty, probably seemed to be on the side of a never search rule. That is a rule that the government can seize digital storage devices incident to arrest, but it isn't allowed to search them unless they've got a search warrant or exigent circumstances. So I think there are probably two votes for that. There might be more. It wasn't clear to me where Justice Ginsburg was. It wasn't entirely clear to me where Justice Breyer was. It wasn't entirely clear to me where Chief Justice Roberts was. So there's there are a couple votes that I just don't quite know where they land, but I think there were two votes for seize and then hold. And effectively imposing a warrant requirement. And then a good amount of time at the argument was spent dealing with this middle ground possibility. That is a rule that the government can search in some cases. They can search maybe only narrowly. This was doctrinally one way of doing this would be through the Supreme Court's decision in Arizona versus Gantt, which effectively adopted a middle ground approach for searches incident to arrest of an automobile when somebody is searched, when somebody is arrested while driving or as a passenger in a car. And the court in the Gantt decision, really channeling Justice Scalia and an earlier concurring opinion he had written, held that if there's reason to believe that there's evidence of the crime of arrest on the phone, which seemed to be some sort of a offense-specific approach, then in that case, the car can be searched pursuant to the search incident to arrest exception, but not otherwise. Justice Scalia suggested that same Gantt rule could apply to cell phone searches. Justice Kennedy also seemed to want to have some sort of a middle ground rule. I think Justice Alito suggested something similar. So several justices were looking for the middle ground, and I think the goal of the middle ground would be to preserve some power to search incident to arrest. So the traditional physical rule is upon making the arrest, they can search everything on the person. The justices seem to want to preserve some of that power, and yet not allow a universal power. I think Justice Scalia said it would be absurd, his word, to allow the government to search a cell phone incident to an arrest for, I think it was driving without a seatbelt, or some traffic violation. Why would you allow the government to search a person's cell phone for that? So they're looking for some sort of middle ground, and the really hard question is what's the middle ground? As I said, Justice Scalia suggested a rule of the reason to believe there's evidence of the crime of arrest on the phone. That's one possibility. Justice Kennedy suggested maybe you draw a line based on the severity of the offense. Michael Dreeben, representing the government, had a couple different proposals. You know, he focused on, and several justices focused on, maybe you draw a line between more and less sensitive information. So, for example, maybe call logs, that is, lists of who was called at what times, maybe that is less sensitive information than, say, the contents of email stored on a phone. So The government also suggested maybe you should have a rule that identity information is allowed, so the government can search the phone to find out whose phone it is, but not find out their communications. So there was a lot of back and forth. A lot of time at the oral argument was spent trying to figure out the pros and cons of different middle ground rules, although to be candid, I didn't get a sense that there was any resolution of any of those debates. And so this is a case where there were 2 hours of oral argument on effectively the same question, and yet at the end, you know, the sense I got from watching the oral argument was now the serious work has to be done. So now the justices have to get together and try to figure out, okay, what's the middle ground rule, and see if there can be a majority formed in favor of some middle ground rule, and they have to do it very late in the term. So, you know, it's almost May, all of the opinions are going to be done and out the door, and the justices have to fly off to Europe for their summer by the end of June. So there's actually only a very tight window of time for them to put together some sort of opinion, and yet this choice of what rule to adopt if you go for some sort of middle ground rule is actually kind of difficult. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. If I had to guess, they'll adopt some middle ground rule, maybe based in the Arizona versus Gantt standard, which is really going back to Justice Scalia's view in an earlier case. But that's really just my guess. If I could just offer a couple broad themes as well about sort of what today's arguments meant. The justices were clearly doing their best to grapple with the new technologies. They all realized, several of them said something along the lines of, you know, computers present a new world, we're in a new world, this is a new environment, we have to figure out what the rules should be for that. I think that if there's any lesson from today's oral argument, it's that the justices seem to be on board with the idea of computer-specific rules. I think once you take that step analytically, that's a huge development in Fourth Amendment law. Many people on the call will be familiar with the idea of specialized rules in the Fourth Amendment setting for automobiles. There's, you know, the automobile exception. There's the rule allowing any traffic violation to justify a stop. Officers allowed to order everybody out of the car. These are all automobile-specific rules, and there's, you know, maybe, I don't know, 20% or 15% of the Supreme Court's Fourth Amendment cases are just about automobiles. And where I think we might be going, based on today's argument, is a world of computer-specific Fourth Amendment rules, with the justices creating rules that apply to digital evidence that may be different from rules that apply to physical evidence, in ways that really try to maintain government power across this shift from physical evidence to digital evidence. And they all seem to be on board with this, and I think Justice Alito even sort of expressly said, you know, we're in this new environment, computers have changed a lot. He drew an analogy to the Jones GPS case 2 years ago, and, you know, we have to sort of find what the new rule is. And all of them seem to be on board, or at least there was no clear dissent from that perspective. So if that's the case, you know, it's going to be really fascinating to watch. And I think a Supreme Court decision, no matter how it concludes in these cases, in terms of which side wins, that says computers are different, we're going to have computer-specific rules, that's going to have enormous implications within Fourth Amendment law. The lower courts, you know, I just imagine the Ninth Circuit taking that ball and running with it. We're going to see a lot of computer-specific rules. And we have seen those in the lower courts already, but I think a Supreme Court directive that's the new way to think about Fourth Amendment law is just going to be incredibly powerful if in fact that happens. Finally, if I had to just make predictions in terms of which side will win, I would say in the flip phone case, I would guess the government wins that case. Just to review the facts of the flip phone case, the government sees the outside of the phone, and it says, I think it was your house calling. Somebody had entered in a listing in the phone such that when that number rang, it came up as text, your home or house or whatever it was. Officer flipped open the phone, saw the number, looked at the call log, you know, found just very minimal information, saw the screen that was viewable once he'd flipped open the phone. I think the justices are going to say that that's sufficiently close to a physical search that would be allowed, looking through someone's wallet, for example, or a booklet in their pocket, that is allowed. And then I don't know how they'll come out in the cell phone, smartphone case, which had a more extensive search. That kind of depends on what rule they take, and it's not at all clear what approach they might take, what middle ground approach they take. But so I think the government will win the flip phone case, and then it's anyone's bet on the smartphone case. So that's an overall perspective, and I'd love to take questions. So why don't we open it up for questions now?
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Professor Kerr, for that excellent presentation. And we should have around 100 people on the call, so we should have plenty of callers interested in asking questions. So in a moment, we'll open the floor to your questions. You'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. All right, and we'll go right away to our first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems the middle ground would be a requirement that there be a warrant for search for specific evidence of a specific crime. We need to keep in mind the Fourth Amendment requirement that warrants are supposed to be somewhat specific. And the problem with these warrantless or non-specific warrants for searching things like cell phones or computers is they can become fishing expeditions. And I think that's contrary to the original intent of the framers of the Fourth Amendment, who wanted anyone conducting a search to know what they were looking for and not to use anything else they might find if it wasn't covered by the warrant. What's your view of that?
Well, a couple clarifications. One, when I'm referring to a middle ground, I mean a middle ground as to when a warrant would be required. So you could say a warrant is always required, a warrant is never required, or a warrant is sometimes required. And when I refer to middle ground, I mean just that the justices were thinking some sort of rule where maybe a narrow search is always allowed without a warrant, but a broader search requires a warrant, something like that. In terms of the role of warrants, that was actually something that came up several times at the argument. A bunch of the justices said, well, if you have a search warrant, then you're going to allow in a very invasive search pursuant to the warrant. So what difference does it make if there's a warrant requirement? I think the big difference of a warrant requirement in a case like this is actually probable cause, not particularity. So the probable cause requirement is probable cause to believe that there's evidence of the crime inside the phone. That's different from the requirement of probable cause to arrest, which is just probable cause to think that a person committed a crime. It's quite commonly the case that a person will, there's probable cause to believe the person committed a crime, but there's not probable cause to believe that there's evidence of that crime in a particular place, such as, for example, on their cell phone. And an easy example of this is the seatbelt violation example. Somebody is arrested for a seatbelt violation. It could be obvious that they were driving without a seatbelt. The officer, saw them driving, and there's a 99% chance that they were in fact driving without a seatbelt. But what are the chances that there's evidence of that on the phone? So a warrant requirement would impose a probable cause requirement to believe that there's evidence in the phone. In terms of particularity, the difficulty is, at least at the lower court level, courts have upheld very broad searches for digitally stored evidence. The difficulty you have with a records-based search is how do you exactly name what it is that the government is looking for. So courts have, this is lower court decisions, have said, for example, you can't say we're going to search the computer for all records. That's clearly not sufficiently particular. But as long as the warrant says, for example, we're searching the computer for or the phone for all records of fraud, that's sufficiently particular. Think about it. That's extremely broad, and yet the courts have said that that's sufficient because it's hard to come up with narrower ways of drafting the warrant. At least that's the argument that the lower courts have made. And if you assume that that's the rule, then the warrant requirement really is not going to make a major difference in terms of particularity. What it's going to do is impose a major difference in probable cause. And then more broadly, a big problem with trying to figure out what exactly is the role of warrants in these cases is that the rules for computer warrant searches are themselves uncertain. So there's a lot of lower court disagreement and circuit splits on the question of what are the rules for searching a computer? What kind of limitations can magistrates impose on warrants to try to limit their scope in the computer context? How does the plain view exception apply to digital evidence? All of these are difficult questions that the lower courts are either unsure of or there's actually an active split on, and it's difficult for the justices to get a sense for how much of a difference warrants are going to make when they don't know what the default rule is for how computer search cases are going to work. So they're making choices among rules in light of doctrinal uncertainty as to the background rules, which makes it extra difficult.
All right. Well, we've got one pending question, and then our lines will be open. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Kerr, enter star and then the pound key.
Hi. I was a bit surprised to see Scalia be so skeptical of warrants. I expected him to do more of a property kind of analysis like he did in the United States v. Jones. What are your thoughts on that idea applying to cell phones?
I wasn't surprised to see where Justice Scalia was on this. I mean, he's very focused on the property-based approach with respect to what is a search. He has long despised the reasonable expectation of privacy test, and his idea of restoring the trespass standard is something I think that he's pretty cares a lot about. But on this issue, everybody agrees that the conduct is a search. It's a question of what is a reasonable search, and on that question, he's been much more flexible. So. Justice Scalia's view of Fourth Amendment reasonableness has been, well, if you have a situation that's really the facts that existed at common law, you apply the common law standard. But if it's something new, it's some sort of new variation, you just look to reasonableness as some general matter and you come up with some sort of balancing test. It's a little bit un-Scalia-like, but it's how Justice Scalia deals with the reality that you have a lot of fact patterns here that are just hard to fit into any of the common law rules. And so the best example of this is his Arizona versus Gantt view, which really started in a concurring opinion in 2004, Thornton versus United States, which was about search incident to arrest in the automobile context. And in that context, Justice Scalia looked at what was then considered the bright line rule of Belton versus New York, and he said, well, the interest that this Belton rule are designed to further doesn't seem to match the scope of the rule, and so we need a more balanced approach, which is more reasonable and more tailored to the justifications for the rule, and that ends up in modified form becoming the majority approach in Arizona versus Gantt. So Justice Scalia, actually, in the reasonableness setting, he's had competing instincts, but at times he'll do the reasonableness approach. Now, I think he's not entirely consistent. Maryland versus King is an example where he more, sticks with the idea of the warrant requirement, and he was much more, sounding that note. Today, he sort of scoffed at the idea that there's even the idea of a warrant requirement. He was like, how can anyone think there's a presumption of a warrant requirement? We occasionally have warrants, but that's the exception, not the rule. So I think there's enough Scalia precedent on this issue that it may be a little bit difficult to square the pieces of the puzzle. But what he said today was consistent with what he had said in Gantt and Thornton.
Excellent. Well, we've got another pending question, so we'll go right along to that, and then our lines will be open. So again, star and the pound key if you've got a question.
I'm just wondering if the justices today demonstrated enough technical knowledge to really be carving out a new area of jurisprudence. I mean, personally, myself, I'm not necessarily a smartphone user or an iPad user. I kind of stopped the computer age and have stopped there. I guess My question is, do you think that this is going to be a highly technical area of jurisprudence ultimately, or is this just going to be distinguishing between smartphone, computers, iPad, for lack of a better term, a dumb phone or a flip phone? I guess I'm just kind of interested in what level or how detailed this could get technologically at this point.
Yeah, it's such a great question, in part because, you know, that not only do you run into the problem of the justices not knowing today's technology, but whatever rule they hand down presumably is going to have to last through tomorrow's technology and then the next year's technology. You know, the technology is changing so quickly that you run the risk of the court enacting a rule today that looks incredibly stupid 10 years from now. So it's a hard puzzle for it. I think they're aware of the difficulties. There was a case, City of Ontario versus Kwan, where the court said, you know, we have to proceed cautiously in this area because the technology is changing quickly and we risk error if we try to decide too much. So I think they're aware of that difficulty. I think the technological complexity of the rule really just depends on what they say the rule is. So let me just offer a couple examples of rules that could have this problem and rules that couldn't have this problem. I think a rule that would run into problems of technological complexity would be if they said, for example, you can search a flip phone but not a smartphone. And there's one, you could say, well, you know, everyone's using smartphones now. You hardly have any flip phones anymore. But actually defining the difference between a flip phone and a smartphone may be difficult. And imagine in 20 years it may be that we have phones where almost all the data is in the cloud. Very little is actually stored on the phone itself, and it's just understood you're getting everything from remote signals. In that case, the technological explanation of what a phone looks like in 20 years might actually begin to look like more how we explain what a flip phone is today. So that's an example of one where you wouldn't want to sort of refer to the nature of the device as the technological line. That's, I think, a recipe for trouble. On the other hand, you could have a rule that says that information relating to the identity of the user, you could even say just phone number information. You could figure out the phone number associated with that phone, that can be determined, and that all other evidence has to be suppressed. That, I think, is something that would survive technological development because it assumes, after all, we're dealing with phones. That is, today, realistically, a computer that has telephone functionality. And there's always going to be some number or some way of contacting that phone. Whatever that number is, that becomes the piece of information that can be obtained. And so that's one example, I think, where that could survive technological change and not require a whole lot of expertise in crafting or implementing the rule. But I think it depends on how they go about it. I mean, I think this is going to be tough. Whoever gets this opinion is going to have to really think through, I think, really three questions. First question, when is any search allowed? You know, what's the trigger that allows any accessing the phone? And then how far is the search allowed? How broadly inside the phone can the search go? And then what evidence is allowed admitted? Is it any evidence is allowed admitted? Is it only evidence that the government is allowed to search for admitted? Those are the three big variables, and there are just a lot of choices to be made among them. So it's hard because there's not a lot of lower court case law on this question. The justices usually wait for, you know, they call it percolation, the lower courts. They want the lower courts to figure out different approaches to the problem. So effectively, the justices, by the time they get to it, they can rely on all the great thought work done by lower court judges. And on this particular question, the scope of the search incident to arrest exception, you have a bunch of cases that have said the search is always allowed. You have a bunch of cases that say the search is never allowed. And then there's really only one decision, a decision by Judge Posner that said the search is sometimes allowed. He tried to sort of draw a balance. I think he said, identity information is allowed, call logs are allowed. You're sort of classifying different kinds of information. There's just not a lot out there other than that. So there's going to be hard work for whatever justice and whatever law clerk perhaps are sitting there trying to figure out what the rule should be. There's work to be done.
Excellent. Well, this is Christian Corgan, and we our lines are open. So if you have a question for Professor Kerr, remember it's star and then the pound key. One quick programming note, our next scheduled telephone conference call will be tomorrow, Wednesday, April 30th at noon Eastern time for a discussion over whether American law schools are failing, featuring the author of the book Failing Law Schools, Professor Brian Tamanaha, as well as Mr. Jim Haynes. Again, that's tomorrow at noon Eastern time. Well, and it looks like, Professor Kerr, you've done an exemplary job of explaining, because we have quite a few callers on the line, but not any more questions at this time. So we'll do one last call for questions. That's star and then the pound key.
As a professor, I think I should say, hey, you in the back. I'll start calling on people if nobody has questions.
Yeah, maybe one day our technology will allow us to just cold call people by number. Well, it looks like we don't have any more questions. So, Professor Kerr, do you have any final thoughts to offer before we conclude?
No, I don't. It's really interesting cases. We'll just have to see how they come down.
Fantastic. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society and the Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, I want to thank Professor Kerr for attending the oral argument and being on the call with us today. I want to thank all of you, the over 100 of you that joined us for the call this afternoon. Again, our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at noon over whether American law schools are failing. So until that time, we're adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.